Hi, is that Edward?
It is, Paul. Hi there, how are you?
Yeah, I'm great, thanks. Hi, it's Paul Scott here, talking to Edward Roscoe. This is our second audio cast. We did one almost a year ago now, amazingly, 26th of October last year, which I just listened back to. And I have to say, it was really good. Lots of interesting insights in that. Just the so I've asked Edward back for a recap nearly a year later to look back at the stocks he talked about then and also to give us some new stock ideas. Quick disclaimer, as always, we're only doing these for entertainment and information purposes. They're not recommendations or financial advice. So, well, welcome, Edward. Shall we start with Finsbury Foods, FIS? That was the first
one mentioned
last year.
Finsbury Foods, about a year ago, they did a large transformational deal, and they raised some finance to help them do that at about 60p or 59p a share of placing.
Yeah.
And to be honest, I thought it was very, very cheap, and the cash generation was good, and the share price didn't move and go anywhere for about 3 months. And I thought, oh, well, I called that one wrongly. And then I think in about January time, the share price started to move up, and I think people got more comfortable that although there were troubles with the supermarkets, some of the key suppliers, were going to still be able to make good money. And so the price rose from about January, and it's currently, I think, at about £1.
Yes.
And so it's had... it's had a lot of re-rating, and that's why I bought it, really, because they've done this good deal. It was trading very cheaply, paid a good dividend, free cash flow was solid, and it's duly re-rated. Probably still got further mileage to go. This is a very talented team. I've reduced down my position a bit. It's still a nice one.
Yeah, I mean, I wish I have no idea why I didn't buy any of these, because, I mean, you mentioned in the audio cast 11 months ago, you summarised by saying, look, it's on a forward PE of 7.5 and there's a 4% dividend yield. It's cheap. And it obviously was. And it's up sort of by 67, nearly 70% in the last year. So well done on that one. I wish I'd listened to you. And I looked at the last set of results, and they were good, weren't they? The acquisitions worked well. And it sounds like they've got more, they sound very ambitious, like they want to expand considerably further, I think.
Yeah, I think they're quite cautious, but a very, very solid team. And they basically turned around the business and sorted things out. And then only with the business on a more firm footing were they prepared to do deals. So I think they will do more deals. They're very, very capital discipline is really important to them. So pricing's got to be right on deals. And on any capex that they do, they've got to have really good return on capital employed. So it's a quality team. It's less cheap than it was.
The 4D I've got now is 11.6.
Yeah,
it's 2.8, isn't it? It has re-rated.
You know, if perhaps it falls back a bit, if the market has a bit of a difficult time, then it might be time to sort of look at it again. But it's not as compelling as it was then.
Okay, that's brilliant. Thanks for that one. Let's move on now. You mentioned Quartix last time, ticker QTX, just before it floated. Now, it seems to have floated around £1.50. This is telematics company. And it's now, a year later, up to £2.58. So that was another great call, Edward.
Paul, I think if I remember correctly, it actually listed at £1.20.
Oh, did it? It must have gone to a premium straight away then.
And it sort of started rising straight away. And then sort of fell back a bit, and it went up to £1.50 and then fell back to £1.20, and then it's been consistently rising ever since.
Yeah.
And it's now at sort of £2.50. I mean, it's a very, very high quality business. It's all, or a very large part of it is contracted recurring revenues, pays quite a good dividend. They're now expanding into the USA. But at the end of the day, when the price has gone up from £1.20 at IPO to, well, double that nearly now, £2.50.
Over double that, £2.58.
It's very much, I think, priced in as a good quality business. But I wish I'd listened to my own advice on that one, because I took some in the IPO.
Yeah.
And I decided that, you know, when it got to about £1.60, I thought, oh, this is getting a bit expensive.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I sold it. And I knew it was a very good quality business. But it just shows you how, you know, fund managers and investors, you know, they're really prepared to pay up something which is growing nicely and has high quality recurring revenues.
Yeah.
So it's a lesson to myself that, you know, when you've backed something which is doing really well, you know, sometimes, you know, one should just let the momentum play out.
Yeah.
And just sit back and leave it. Maybe do a little bit of trimming, but not sort of, you know, sell out and say, oh, didn't I do well? I made 25% when things then go on to much higher levels.
Yeah, no, fair comment. I mean, it does look very pricey now, I must say, just looking at the fundamentals. But, you know, so you, I take it you wouldn't wouldn't buy back at this value.
No, not at these levels. And, you know, it's always possible. If I remember correctly, they did, they had some insurance business where they were selling products, not the recurring revenues. And if for some reason one of those insurance contracts they didn't get or they lost it, it would hit their gross profit quite a bit.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Right. So, no, I think at that price level, I'd sort of, you know, wait and watch and see what happens and only re-enter if there was a misstep or something.
Okay. And then telematics has been a fantastic sector for you because your other stock in that is TrackMate, ticker TRAK. Now, I think, I mean, you've done spectacularly well on this one. I mean, I think you had a disposable stake in it at one point, I think, didn't you?
I did at one point.
Have you cut back a bit since then?
It's no longer disclosable. They've issued a bit more stock, and it's sort of gone down below 3%. And it was only very slightly over that level. And this is a really interesting one because, you know, what can I learn from it? I originally met them, it must have been in the autumn of 2013, I think it was, about 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And the management team were raising a little bit of money to help with the acquisition of Box Telematics. And it was one of those meetings where I came away very, very impressed with the management team, partly because they were raising £2 million of new money, and the management team were putting in £1 million of the £2
million. Oh, good grief. That's extraordinarily bullish signal, isn't it? Yeah.
The finance director, and you know how finance directors are always very cautious, he was writing out a cheque for £150,000.
Wow.
But it wasn't just that. It was that they were just very balanced and sensible, and they bootstrapped the business very carefully. And the Box transaction was going to be quite transformational for them in terms of scaling up. They bought it at a very good price. And I sort of said to myself at that time, you know, I think it took the shares in that placing were at 22p. And the price began to rise, and I still kept buying all the way up to probably about 70p because I still thought it was sort of quite inexpensive in modest amounts. And I thought when it got to a pound, I'd sort of set my target, and I thought, well, I think a pound would be fair value. And actually, it's very important that one sort of, I think, reappraises an investment and sort of looks forward and asks what's changed because actually, at a pound, you know, there was still plenty to go for. And duly, the price has now risen and the price is now £2. And sometimes with these things, I'm just saying to myself, you know, rather than trying to be too clever and sort of, you know, sell out along the way and, you know, actually to sort of hold it for much longer, maybe do a little bit of top slicing and recognize if one's backed a sort of really quality management team, because they're going to keep on doing interesting M&A, interesting acquisitions, interesting organic growth. You know, in this company, they own 40% of the equity across all of the management team members.
Still.
And it's quite well spread. I mean, it's not just the CEO, it's, you know, exec chairman, it's also other divisional operating managers as well. So there's a lot at stake for the management team here. So they're going to be pretty sensible about what they do. And although the valuation, I can't can't remember what it is at the moment. But
well, it's not extreme at all. That's the interesting thing. I mean, looking at the Stockopedia page here, I mean, the broker consensus forecasts just keep going up. So, you know, even though the share price goes up, it's on a forward PE of 15.3, which is not... It's not expensive at all, really, is it?
It's sort of okay, but if I remember correctly, the tax charge is a little bit flattered because they're not paying tax, and at some point that will normalise.
Wouldn't that be normalised in the broker forecast?
No, it's definitely not. I looked at this.
So that moves it up to a P of about 18 then, doesn't it?
Yes, but they've got a couple of years before that happens. Yeah. And then I suppose the most interesting thing is they bought earlier this year... a camera company, the idea being that forward-facing cameras on vehicles, when teamed up with telematics, is quite a powerful combination. And that's all to do with, if you're a lorry driver and you have a crash, you want to have the evidence to say, well, actually it was or wasn't my fault.
Yeah.
So that's quite interesting, and that was another example of a small deal they did. I think they paid about £3.5 million for it. It was at a good acquisition multiple, if I remember correctly. It was sort of 5-6 times EBIT type numbers, so it wasn't expensive. And it just goes to show that, you know, the right management team, they'll keep on finding sensible bolt-ons to do, and therefore, you know, I think one just has to keep appraising as the share price goes up. Is there still stuff to go for? Has anything fundamentally changed? And even sometimes when the price looks a bit expensive, you know, you just have to sort of say, well, actually, this is a management team who's really delivered. I'll slightly give them the benefit of the doubt in terms of if the price is looking a little bit expensive. They'll find some other way to drive shareholder value.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kicking myself in this one. I just dug my notes out while we were talking from my alphabetical storage system. And I had a long chat with the CEO and FD of this company when the stock was 18p, so less than a tenth of the current price. And I tried to buy but couldn't get any stock.
Yeah, that was the problem. It was quite difficult to buy the stock, you know, and therefore, to a certain extent, one had to, you know, be very patient and sit on the bid and wait for stock to come to you, and you could only buy small amounts and things.
Yes.
I remember I had a chance to buy a block of 100,000 shares at 35p, and I argued about the price and would only pay 34.
It's crazy, isn't it? You made this point in the last audio cast, actually.
Did I?
You said when you find an absolute stock you're sure about, don't try and be too cute over a penny or either way on the price, just pay up and run with it.
Well, there you go. I need to take my own medicine. I remember it very well, you know, and I sort of, you know, and you know, well, that was silly, wasn't it? That was silly. Anyway,
did you get the stock there at 34?
No.
Oh, no.
It went off to somebody else. It was a good block, a good size.
Yeah.
But anyway, so that one I think is a very solid company.
Yeah. I should say I hold some of those as well. I eventually bought a few at £1.48
Well, it's now £2 or something or thereabouts.
Yeah.
That's absolutely fine. And the answer on this one I think is, you know, I'll have it in my portfolio as a sort of core holding, and we'll give it, you know, another year to run and see how things go.
Yeah. Okay.
And it'll bob up and down a bit between, I don't know, £1.80. It seems to have found a range of £1.80 to sort of £2-ish. And maybe on a bad day, I mean, when we had the crash, the sort of market setback, the small setback in August, on a single day.
That was when I bought.
Well, slightly huge, because it went all the way down to £1.50, you know, quite precipitously. So it just shows that, you know, if you keep your powder dry and wait, sometimes things do come to you at good prices.
Yeah, and it went straight back up again, didn't it? That was the interesting thing.
Yeah, it didn't stay down there very long.
No, it was less than an afternoon, I think. Okay, so that was done really well. So that's three bags just since our last audio cast, amazingly.
So
astonishing success on that one, and we both still hold that one as well. Now, Seeing Machines, that's an interesting one, isn't it?
Yeah, this is a very interesting one. And I have a lot of time for the management team, and they're very credible and competent. The thing that has always been terrifying me about this company is the amount of cash they're burning through.
Yes.
And I looked at they very recently did a very good deal, and they sold their technology to Caterpillar for use in the mining space. That's been the core sector focus, mining, DSS product into mining. And they did a good deal, and they got, off the top of my head, I think they got $17.5 million up front. Some of it paid...
Aussie dollars or
US
dollars?
No, that's US dollars. Aussie dollars, if I remember correctly.
Okay.
$22.5 million Aussie dollars. They've got some of it up front. Some of that comes up front by sort of January time, and then the balance comes over the next 2 years. And then they get an interesting royalty on all the products sold by Caterpillar. But here's an interesting thing. In the year ending June 2015, they sold, if I remember correctly, 1,000 units of DSS. Okay? The broker forecast says that, you know, under the ownership of Caterpillar in the first full year, they're going to sell 900 units. Now, what that's really saying is, you know, as with any big company, when they buy something, they take a bit of time to digest it and work out how they're going to sell it more effectively when they own it. Okay? So there's a bit of sort of, if you like, incubation time to work out, okay, well, we now own this, how are we going to push it through our channels, what are we going to do differently? And then I think it's probably also reflective of the fact the mining sector's tough.
Well, I'm going to say, of the one sector to concentrate it on, it's probably the worst one imaginable.
So that's, you know, and to be honest, I was quite negative on Seeing Machines because I thought that when I looked at the cash flow statements, I thought they would need to raise money this autumn. Because the till was running empty, the tank was running empty, and they were burning about 20 million Aussie dollars a year, roughly. And then they've done this deal with Caterpillar, which has given them a bit of a shot in the arm. But effectively, the broker forecast is still saying that this year, they're still going to be burning 20 million. So basically, most of the money they've got from Cat will be spent on operating expenditures between now and June 16.
So it defers another placing by a year, basically, doesn't it?
Yeah, and maybe they make more progress and do some positive things. But it's still, you know, it's still burning cash at really quite a high rate.
Yes.
And what they're really depending on over the next year is to make a lot of progress on their fleet product. And off the top of my head, I think the brokers were saying, well, you know, they've got a significant scale-up on fleet forecast, going up to 5,000 units, if I remember correctly, for June 16, from, I think it was about 800 units or something for this year just ended. And so it's quite a tall order. They've got a lot of work to do on fleet. And, you know, I'm not sure whether they're going to be, you know, as successful as they hope on that. We just don't quite know. They've sold successfully already into the South African trucking market.
But don't you think the sort of thing where the news flow could suddenly make the thing explode upwards? You know, if they say a major insurance company has, rolling out or something.
Possibly, but Paul, I tend to like to buy things based on sort of value and fundamentals for them. It's burning 20 million Aussie dollars a year. They've got another lease of life with this money from Caterpillar. You know, but unless they make success with the fleet product, you know, there's going to be trouble ahead.
I agree. I think the clock's ticking on this one, isn't it? I sold about a third of my holding before results just to be on the safe side. I'm going to sort of give it another 6 to 9 months, and then I think if there hasn't been, you know, major progress by then, I'll probably chop these out.
It's quite interesting if you look at the share price graph, and an interesting comment actually. I remember Anthony Bolton once said, the nice thing about a share price graph is it should be, if you want to have a quick snapshot and a view of a company, the share price graph should reflect all the information and knowledge that the market has.
Yeah, that's true.
Right?
Yeah.
So it's a sort of a simulation of everything. And if you look at the share price graph on Seeing Machines, they raised I think it was £16 million in December 2000, and I think it was...
13, wasn't it?
13, I think it was, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
So, sort of two-ish years ago, and if you look at the share price graph, it hasn't really, with the exception of a bit of a spike up to sort of 8, 9p, it's been downhill all the way.
Yes, you get a flurry of excitement every now and again with it, don't you, with a bit of news flow and whatever, and then it drifts again.
But basically...
Well, 5p, it's holding around 5p though, isn't it? 4.5, 5p.
Yeah, it's about 4.5 to 5p. What's interesting is there's now 930 million shares in issue, or that sort of order of shares.
Yeah.
And I think that what frightens me here is that if there was any clumsy seller or somebody trying to get out of 10 million shares... which is only 1% of the company, you know, as somebody said to me, you know, it would bury the price.
Do you think? I mean, it's reasonably liquid, this one. Not liquid, but I mean, you could dribble out stock, but
you maybe get it out gradually over a period of time, but then what happens is it tends to, the buying interest tends to dry up after a while.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, between announcements especially.
This one, at the end of the day, I'm sort of, it's a good management team, but I'm quite cautious on because of their cash burn.
Yes.
They've got another lease of life with this money from Caterpillar, but they've got quite a lot to prove on the fleet product.
Yeah, okay.
And Do you still hold this one? I don't hold any of this.
I do, but only a smallish position.
I did hold it, but I don't hold it anymore because I thought the risk profile was too high. And I just couldn't be sure about how it would play out.
Okay. We better move on a bit.
Yeah, sorry.
I've got to type all this up. So the longer we go on, the more bigger a job it becomes. Tungsten.
Here's an interesting one.
You quite liked it last time. You said you've been trying to buy at £2.13, but it hadn't gone that low. Well, we're now 60p, so it's probably bloody good.
Let me tell you what happened on this one. I was buying, I think, in December 14, and I did eventually buy a sort of position. And then in about mid-January, they came out with a horrendous profit warning, and they basically said, you know, we're not going to make our, I think it's a May year end, this one, we're not going to make our numbers. And it wasn't that they were not going to make their numbers by a little bit, it was by miles. Right. And also, I think it pushed back the numbers for the year-end 16 as well.
I have a feeling, you know, they didn't actually put a profit warning out. I have a feeling the broker just put out revised forecasts.
Yeah, you're probably being
miles adrift.
Absolutely.
The private investors were left floundering, not knowing that, you know, they were going to miss forecasts by a mile.
Well, I mean, essentially there was, you know, they downgraded the forecast in a very material way in mid-January.
Yeah.
And I was furious because I felt that it must have been obvious to the management team in December, probably since November, but certainly in December, that they were not going to achieve, or they were unlikely to achieve, the year-end numbers.
Yeah, I agree.
And I therefore felt that they had been cavalier in the way that they had communicated with the market. And I decided, therefore, in light of that, that the integrity of management, I basically couldn't trust Eddie. And he communicated very badly with the market. And if you also remember, funnily enough, Michael Spencer, as a non-exec, came off the board at the end of December or very early January.
Yeah.
And I suspect that with hindsight, it was because he may well have been very, very displeased about the guidance they were giving the market, and he felt that they should have been guiding the market better. So, again, at the time, I didn't read too much into Michael Spencer's stepping down. But with hindsight, I think that it was a sign of problems ahead.
Yeah.
And this company has had big problems ahead because, as you know, they then had to go and raise money. The share price went into free fall. Fortunately, by this stage, I was so fed up with it that I had sort of cut my losses and sold out between sort of, I don't know, £1.60 and £1.80. Mm-hmm. And I was completely out of it. But then things, you know, took several turns for the worse.
Mm-hmm.
And if I remember correctly, they then had to do a capital raise at ATP, I think it was.
Something like that, wasn't it? Yeah. I mean, do you think there's a buying opportunity? I mean, I agree with all of that. I mean, I think it's badly tarnished goods, this one. But and the trouble is the take-up rate on the early payment discount product has only been tiny so far. You know, for all of Editrall's trillions and hundreds of billions and all the rest of it that he likes to talk about, the actual numbers are paltry, aren't they, really?
Yeah, I haven't reviewed it lately, so I'm probably not up to speed enough on it. I'm cautious in terms of their need to sort of scale up on the, if I remember correctly, it was on the analytics and the early payment discount mechanism.
Yeah.
I think the price is now back, is down at 60p, isn't it?
60p, yeah. Mind you, it's still 75 million market cap.
Yeah, it may be one worth researching, but I don't really feel any need to sort of jump into this one. I suspect that investors are all a bit burnt and, you know, once bitten, twice shy. Mm-hmm. So one may well find it best to watch from the sidelines, do one's research, be up to speed on it, and then may then be
to act if there's a bigger, you know, positive announcement.
And then wait until there's some positive news, and we may then find that the news doesn't get fully reflected in the share price.
Yeah.
Because everybody's
okay.
A bit jaundiced by this story
and
disappointed and doesn't necessarily trust management.
Yeah.
So I think this one, that's a case of sort of...
One to watch, sir.
One to watch, but with extreme caution.
Okay.
Yeah.
We better move on, we're just running out of time here. So let's move on to some of your new current stocks. Now, I should emphasise these are all very, very small. They're microcaps, really, so horribly illiquid, hideous spreads and so on. So, you know, much bigger sort of shiny flashing warnings over these ones than usual.
Yeah, we'll talk on the for each one about sort of liquidity and how to deal with it. What do we have first on the list, Paul?
So STM was the first one. This is a sort of pensions administration company.
Yeah, this is a very, very interesting company. I am about as excited about this one as I was about TrackMate when I met them.
Wow. Okay.
The interesting thing here is that then the main business which they do is they do something called a qualifying recognised overseas pension scheme, which basically is a pension scheme wrapper for expats and overseas people.
Yeah.
And the nice thing about pensions administration businesses is that the running costs are very, very low to administer one of these. So you have a lot of setup costs, you've got lots of regulatory requirements, lots of things you have to get right, and it's a business where you've got to have scale. But once you've got the customer on board, what you have to do annually to look after that policy is not that much, because you've got all the systems and processes in place. And what piqued my interest on this one is it has an amazingly robust recurring revenue business model. So it signs up and somebody with a new pension, they're the administrator for, and it's a bit like an annuity revenue stream, because the number of people who once they're signed up and they're having somebody administer their pension, particularly if it's an overseas pension like this, which is a very specialist area, they don't really move, Paul. And so if you've got people who are going to be having this pension, and their typical age, if I remember correctly, is about 40, so they're going to be running this for about another 20 years at least before they go into drawdown, or 15 to 20 years. And the churn rate for this company in terms of lost customers for STM, we're talking sub 2%, 3%. It's tiny, right? And they are, at the beginning of this year, they had roughly 7,500 policies being administered, and they are adding roughly 250 policies a month or 3,000 policies a year.
Okay.
Doesn't sound very much, but...
Almost 20% growth.
No, it's more than that, because it's 3,000 policies, and they've started the year with 7,500.
Oh, sorry, actually, I thought you said 17,000.
No, 7,500. So it's 40% organic growth in policy numbers. Now, it'll slow off a little bit, but the drop-through, and what people don't fully appreciate here, is the operational gearing in this business. So, essentially, you put another policy in the top of the machine, and you don't really add any costs associated with it. Right? And these policies, the annual fees, are, because they're specialist and things, roughly £700-800.
Yeah.
And what this means, long and the short of it, is that if you do a simple model and you say they keep adding 3,000 policies a year for the next couple of years, the profits go absolutely through the roof because they're not adding very much more cost to go with it. And so if I remember correctly, the broker has a forecast of sort of EPS to December 15 of about 4p.
Yeah.
And then the broker has another forecast of about 5p for next year, 16. But when I do my own numbers, it looks to me that the broker is seriously undercooking this.
Okay.
And I expect, you know, more like 6p of earnings. So the thing trades at about 55p. And, you know, on the broker forecast for next year, that would be sort of 11 times next year's earnings. But I think it's going to be less. The earnings is going to be more, and the PE is going to be much less.
So your PE is working about roughly 9 instead of 11, isn't it?
Exactly. And how much?
And
you get a
higher rating because the rate of the
This is the other thing people haven't really factored in. If you've got a business which is growing earnings at, let's just say, 40 to 50% per year, it really shouldn't be on a PE of forward PE of 11.
No, I agree. I mean, the only thing that puts me off, I mean, I've met the management team of this one and looked into it myself. On the face of it looks amazing. But a mutual friend of ours said, be careful with it. The whole QROP space is...
Absolutely. I think I know who that mutual friend is, and he's now sort of looking at it again. Slightly changing his mind.
There's a couple of
issues, risk issues on this stock. One is... a lot of the business gets referred to them by a independent financial advisor specializing in expats called De Vere.
De Vere generate them
about 70% of their new business. Okay? So you've got a risk in terms of that revenue concentration coming from that introducer.
Yes.
And secondly, you've always got, with pensions, you've got regulatory risk in terms of if the government were to change the rules around QROPs, how would they change it? What might it mean?
It is a commercial area, isn't it? The regulators are looking at it, I believe.
Yes. I mean, again, what people perhaps don't realise is that under EU law, there's this movement of capital across Europe. You need to be able to move your capital across Europe, and therefore... there is a degree of protection under EU law for somebody who's got a pension in the UK moving it to a QROP scheme in Malta, which is also part of the EU. So it's not as simple as saying, well, actually, the government might decide to shut this down and wouldn't do it anymore. They can't do that. What they have done is to restrict, to make sure that any scheme, overseas scheme to which a pension from the UK is being transferred, meets the HMRC guidelines and is approved. And in this sense, I spent a lot of time looking at this and discussing this with the management team, and they are at the white end of QROPs. By that I mean they are doing it absolutely by the book.
Okay.
So, for example, some QROPS providers were saying to people, oh, well, if you move to us, you can take your pension at 50. Right? The STM one has always been, no, sorry, it's 55. That's what HMRC says. We're not going to play fast and loose and allow you to take it at 50.
Right. Okay.
And that, in that sense, therefore, they're very much approved by HMRC. They're on the list. They're approved. And they are being very careful to make sure they do it all by the book.
Mm. Okay. We better move on, Edward, just as time. Any final remarks on STM that we haven't
covered? I would just say that the CapEx requirements in this sort of financial services administrator business are minimal.
Yeah.
But I expect them to move to a dividend, and it could be quite a generous payout.
Okay.
They could pay out probably 50% of earnings without sort of hurting themselves very much.
Yeah, because it last paid a divvy in 2010. And
no, it's all going to change. I think it's all going to change. Okay. They've hinted at it in the last interim results. Mm. And I think, if off the top of my head, I think they'll end the year with cash on them, no debt.
Yeah.
They'll end up with sort of cash in the order of £8 million.
Okay. Oh, I might have to revisit this one, because I did have a few, but I sold them after talking to our mutual friend, so
I've made this quite a significant high conviction buy for myself, and I think it's got a lot of very, very attractive dynamics that people just don't realise how powerful the business model is.
Okay. Right, we've got to just do very quick blasts through the last three.
Okay.
The first one, Cambridge Cognition, which I know quite well. That's the testing, electronic testing for dementia, isn't it?
Yeah, neuropsychological testing. Market cap's about 17 million, quite tightly held.
Why have they shot up in the last month, other than the fact that I sold mine about 6 weeks ago?
I think that I'm told that there was somebody who wanted to buy stock, and it's a small company, and therefore there's not much stock around.
I
wouldn't necessarily be sort of chasing it up at these levels.
Mm-hmm.
But equally, it's not stupidly priced. It's got a market cap of about £17 million. It's got very, very unique technology. And, you know, and the revenues, I can't remember it off the top of my head, it will be about
$7 million.
$7 million.
I think it's around break-even, isn't it?
Break-even.
One bit's profitable and the other bit sort of is subsidising and developing.
Yeah, what they're doing is taking the cash flow from the academic business and the clinical trials business and investing that in the healthcare business. And they've made some progress on the healthcare side, so they're now using their product for in the occupational health market. So essentially employers providing this test, if I remember correctly, through Bupa and some of the private health insurers, providing this test as part of people's annual medical appraisal.
Oh, okay, that's interesting.
And this is a software business, so they're then getting quite good license fees with little costs associated with it.
Yeah.
And so this is beginning to look quite a lot more interesting in terms of the healthcare side. Mm. And we'll just have to see how they scale up on that.
Okay. You know,
that's interesting. It's a very unusual company.
But yeah, again, I've held that one for a year or 18 months, and in the end I just got fatigue on it and sold at exactly the wrong point. It's just Sod's Law, isn't it? It has just been going sideways for a year or two, and you know, you get bored and sell, and then off it shoots up.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes I think it's best, you know, trim down a little bit, but keep a little bit in the bottom drawer just in case.
Yeah, okay. Should we...
Yes.
Move on that one. Next one, Thalassa.
Thalassa. Now, this is very interesting. This is a deep value play. Basically, who wants to buy something at the moment in oil field services? Nobody.
Yes. Is it some sort of size? Do they do seismic?
Yeah, they do life field seismic, which basically is not seismic for exploration. It's seismic where you found the well, you're producing from it, but you're using the seismic to try and optimise your recovery rates.
Oh, I see.
And interestingly enough, the Norwegian government has been really encouraging operators who are subject to taxes in Norway to use life of field monitoring, because essentially they can improve the recovery rates. And, you know, that means bigger tax revenues for the Norwegian government.
Yeah.
So there's quite a lot of interest in my mind here, where you've got a government saying, actually, we want you to use this because you can optimise and enhance your recovery rates.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, where you've already got an existing well and it's been drilled and it's producing, optimising your recovery rates and getting out as much as possible is very, very attractive because you've already got the sunk cost.
Yes.
So they're one of sort of half a dozen people who can do life of field on a turnkey contract. Mm-hmm. They won a huge deal with Statoil as their first deal, and they are currently waiting on a tender on something else, which they're going to hear from imminently, like in the next week or so. Mm. And that will be potentially with another large oil company. And if they get that, that's really, you know, transformational for them because it's a second major contract.
Okay.
So that's like the inception.
I should just say the ticker. Ticker THAL on this one.
THAL. And why the cheap value play is at the end of the day, the market cap is roughly, was it about 10 million, 11 million?
Yeah, 11 million.
They had cash in the middle of September of $17.5 million. Cash.
Wow.
No debt.
So
called 12
cap.
Million pounds, the whole market cap. Plus, if you look at their balance sheet, it's stuffed full of assets that they use for their life of field seismic. And the balance sheet net asset value is about 40 million. There's one impairment they probably, you know, they've taken their impairments, all their impairments. There's one loan to the EBT trust of about 7 million. And if you exclude that as an asset, then you get to a net asset value of about $32 million.
Gosh.
Right? Which is, I think, that comes up at about, let's just say roughly, roughly a bit over £20 million.
About double market cap.
Which is about £1 a share.
Yeah, and that's
so that's why I say it's a deep value play, hugely out of favour. There has been a stock overhang which got cleared last week.
Okay.
And I think this for me is attractive because it's very contrarian, very big downside underpinning it. You know, with the cash and the net asset value. And maybe they win this large contract. But even if they don't, it doesn't matter because they're sitting there on all that cash and these assets. And something is going to happen to them in a positive way. So this is very asymmetric risk-reward. And that's, again, why I bought it.
Right, that does sound interesting. So one last one, then. WATR, what's that one?
Oh, gosh, yes, right. This is Water Intelligence. This is a very small cap company.
Oh, this is the American franchise thing.
The American leak detection company. This is illiquid and difficult to buy and very tightly held.
$6.5 million market cap.
About 10 million shares in issue, $6.5 million market cap. It's a franchise business, so they get basically a 7% of all revenues that the franchisees put through the system.
And it's for things like swimming pools leaking, isn't
Well, anything in your home. It could be a swimming pool leak. It could be a leak in your house. It's got a national footprint. Across the franchise, it does about $70 million of revenue a year across the franchise. Mm-hmm. And then, as I say, they're taking a roughly 7% franchise fee. And the nice thing about franchises is that, obviously, the capital employed is quite low. It's just how you manage them. You've got to manage them well. So that is quite a cash-generative, robust business on the franchise side. The interest here is that they're now buying in some of the underperforming franchises and turning them into corporate stores. And very simple terms, they should be able to do a successful franchisee does about a 25 to 30% EBIT margin. So, in simple terms, if they were to buy in or have their own stores over a period of time doing, say, $10 million of revenue, that would make them $2.5 million of EBIT, which is a huge uplift from where they are at the moment.
Yeah.
So, and they've begun to buy in some of these stores. They bought some in, if I remember correctly, in Chicago and in Florida, and they'll buy in some more. And so it's, you know, it's interesting, and its small size doesn't really reflect the, you know, the franchise overall revenues of 70 million.
I see. Yes. Yes, of course. Yeah, it's a much bigger business than it appears because
exactly.
The revenue line is only the franchise fees.
Exactly. So the interest here is if they can, over a period of time, build up on their own corporate side, their own stores, the revenue could increase very substantially.
Okay, that does sound interesting. I know I have looked at it once, but I rejected it because it was so illiquid.
It is very, very illiquid. You know, and the answer is, again, one has to buy just a few, try and buy a few when there's a seller around.
Yeah.
Yeah, and not chase it.
Uh-huh.
You know, and, I mean, if I remember correctly, Amati were buying some in the mid-40s.
Right, okay.
It doesn't trade that much, but the flip side of that is that it's reasonably tightly held and, you know, the price only comes down when there's a seller if there isn't a buyer that matches it up. But I'd be quite careful about buying it and not chasing the price.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. Okay. Just one final stock that I know we both know quite well. I hold. I don't know if you still do. Sinetti, S-N-T-Y. Now, about obviously they had a disastrous cock up with the placing where the share price collapsed because they. You know, market didn't realise they were going to need more money, and then they said then they did, and total mess. But the price seems to be firming up now around the placing price, doesn't it? Around 90p.
Yeah, I'm quite positive on this company for two reasons. One, it now has Peter Simmons, who was the previous chief exec of Dot Digital, and really understands SaaS businesses, and he is the chairman here, and he came in. And I think he's been giving them a bit of his sort of advice to try and help them along the way. So that's very positive in terms of a senior mentor who really understands SaaS sitting on the board. Mm. And then the second reason to be positive is that Helium, the fund management group.
Helium Rising Stars have been buying.
Helium Rising Stars have a position.
They've gone from 16% to 18% recently, haven't they?
And David Newton, the fund manager there, very much cornerstoned the recent Sinity placing, which was done at, was it 90p? I think it was.
Yeah, it was.
So I think there's everything to, you know, that things are lining up with the right board structure, right shareholder base. But I think the challenge here is that, you know, it's still got to... you know, keep growing and developing. And, you know, sometimes these businesses, they actually would benefit from still a bit more money to really go a bit faster.
Yeah, I think they're still tight on cash, even though they raised some quite recently. I mean, I think they'll definitely need to do another fundraise. Maybe not a huge one, but...
it won't be from a distressed position. It'll be more from a position of, this is what we've delivered, this is why we're doing it.
We just need a bit more to push us over the line. We want to go a bit faster.
I mean, one interesting point, if you look at, there's a key competitor in this space called New Voice Media, which is private equity backed, and which has had, I think, a huge funding round. I think they had $30 or $40 million dollars injected into them. So, again, when you're competing in a marketplace where other people have got much more cash to spend on the sales and marketing, it can make it quite tough. So, you know, it's an interesting company in an interesting space, you know, with the right, you know, with good input from Peter Simmons as chairman and with Helium Rising Stars, you know, but they've still got a lot to do.
Yeah. I mean, I think
a little bit more money in due course to go a bit faster.
Yeah. I agree. I mean, looking back at this time last year, I thought it's a nice concept, it might work. Now I'm looking at it and thinking, actually, I think this is going to work, but it'll probably need a bit more money to get push it over the line, you know?
Yeah, and this is one of those classic things where, you know, if companies need to come back to the market for more money, they're not then in control of their future.
Yeah.
And if the market does a bit of a, you know, is a bit sceptical or uncertain about it, then the pricing for that new money can be very, very much lower than previous rounds of the current share
price. Which goes back to your comments on tungsten as well, doesn't it? I mean, as a corporate finance man, Edward, why is it that when companies float and raise money in the first place, they don't seem to build in a contingency reserve? I mean, that seems to be a mistake that so many companies make.
I mean, maybe one can say it's an entrepreneur is always optimistic. If he wasn't optimistic, he'd never found his business in the first place.
Yeah, that's true.
And therefore, when they come to raise money, they often think they've put in a contingency. It just doesn't happen to be enough. Or things take so much longer than they were anticipating that they just, you know, they blow through the contingency very easily.
Yeah, I see. Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's rather like saying, tungsten, which did do a secondary and I think raised some additional money. I can't remember the price. I think it was over £3 at one stage. They raised a little bit of extra money.
Yes, and they did a really fast, and management put in, £2.7 million into that raise as well.
So they did still raise above £3. You know, but then when the writing was on the wall and people realised that it wasn't delivering as they had anticipated, and they're going to need significantly more money, and there's more uncertainty about whether the business model is going to get proved out, you know, as originally planned, investors then can sort of reappraise the whole investment completely. And it's an acid test, you know, if, you know, you say to yourself, well, if I'm not invested in this company already, what do I think it's worth, and at what price am I prepared to give them capital now? And it can often be at a very, very changed price compared with what people were thinking previously.
I mean, because the original funds are now a sunk cost, aren't they? They're gone. So you start from zero with the valuation.
That's why it's always very interesting. If there is going to be a capital raise and it's going to be done from a position of weakness, right, one then has to be incredibly cautious.
Yes.
Because the market price may bear no relationship whatsoever to the price at which they have to raise money.
Yeah,
and obviously then over time, the price in the market will adjust to the price at which they raise the money, because that is effectively a market testing mechanism where people have been asked, if you are to put in tens of millions of pounds into this company, right, and we're not restricted by liquidity issues or anything else, what price would you like to do it at?
That's a very good point, yeah.
Right, and, you know, another example would be Blur, for example, where, you know, it had been up to £7. You know, it was all just fantasy. If I remember correctly, Philip Letts sold out some stock at a high price, can't remember, £3 or whatever it was, but sold out some stock. And then as the writing became clearer on the wall that they were going to need more money and things weren't going to plan, and they had revenue recognition issues, you know, they then raised the money in the end at 80p.
Wow.
Right?
And it's a lot lower than that now, I think.
And now, and I thought at the time, to be honest, I couldn't understand why anybody would put money in at 80p.
No.
Because I felt it was still at that price level, you know, very uncertain. And sure enough, you know, over time, the price has sunk lower, you know, getting to the low or mid-20s.
I mean, I don't think they'd have a viable business model.
They may not. Who knows is the answer. But, you know, I think they raised quite a lot of money at 80p. I can't remember the amount. If I say to you it was, I think it was pushing 15 or 20 million pounds.
Okay, yeah.
That's a lot of money to have put up for that company.
Yes.
But you can see from the price action that those people who put money up at 80p don't fancy buying any shares down at 25p now.
fair point.
Or, you know, another one would be sort of Wandisco, where I thought the writing was on the wall a long time ago in terms of the rate of growth, the valuation.
Yeah, I did. I put it on my barge pole list at about 5 a share, I think.
Well done you, right? And, you know, the things kept sinking. And
what
they took on new brokers. It went off to UBS and I can't remember who else did it. Was it Investec? I can't remember. Who got them some more money in at £3.75.
Oh, yeah,
I think that was in the beginning of the year, I think.
It's only £1.06 it is now, isn't it?
Well, you wouldn't feel too clever, would you, if you put money in at £3.75?
No, I mean, the last set of figures were terrible. I mean, absolutely pedestrian growth rates, but the thing's just hemorrhaging cash.
It's a big sort of lesson on these things that, you know, story stocks or concept stocks or blue sky stocks or things which you're not certain how they'll play out, right? If things don't play out as planned, it will sink like a stone.
Yeah.
Another example would be Flow Group. And none of this is sort of, you know, it's just one of those things that, you know, there may be circumstances which management is not in control of that cause it to sort of, you know, to reappraise, you know, it gets reappraised.
And it's not, that one's just not going to work, is it? I don't think.
But I haven't studied it in detail. The irony is sometimes when everybody has given up hope, right, and it's fallen to very, very low prices, it may actually at that point be interesting. And I sometimes have this expression, the second mouse gets the cheese.
Oh, I like it. Yes.
Which basically means let everybody else put their money in.
Yeah.
Let them all get despondent. Let the thing get really beaten up.
Yes.
And then you've got lots of data points and lots of passage of time to assess how it's been working or not working.
Yeah, brilliant. I love it.
And you may find as the second mouse that you get the cheese and then it's a really nice prize. And you got it at a really good price because everybody else has sort of given up.
Yeah, I think that's a brilliant point, and that's definitely the point we're going to have to end on, Edward. We could talk for hours. It's been fascinating, but I've got to type all this up, remember.
I'm so sorry, Paul.
Don't apologise. It was wonderful. I always get real insights from you, Edward, so thanks for your
time. And as I say, I think, you know, I also read something interesting the other day, which is, you know, with every investment, new investment, be fearful investing. Really be fearful. Don't get excited about it. Think what could go wrong.
Yeah.
How well covered is the downside? What could go wrong?
Yeah.
And out of all those things we've talked about, I think I'd say go and do the research on STM.
So STM's your favourite
one. Yeah.
Okay. Brilliant. Thanks, Edward. That was fantastic.
A pleasure, Paul. Nice to chat with you. And,
well, likewise, I will be hovering over a hot keyboard all night now typing this up.
Okay, cool. Nice to chat with you.
Thanks. We'll do another one in 6 months or a year or something?
Exactly, and we'll see. I'm sure I've got everything wrong.
Well, I mean, you certainly didn't last time, so I think there'll be a lot of people...
Well, that means on the reversion to the mean, I'm bound to get all wrong this time.
Oh, brilliant. Thanks ever so much, Edward. Really
appreciate
it.
Okay, pleasure, Paul. Take care. Bye.
Cheers now. Bye.